Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. Thanks for joining us today. You know, I love podcasts. It's like getting time back in your day because you can listen to podcasts while you drive or walk or exercise or do things around the house. You get time back because you can be learning while you're doing. So wherever you are right now, in the car or on the treadmill or at your desk, seeking a little bit of inspiration, whatever you're doing, I hope this podcast today helps you open your eyes to some new ways of thinking and doing. And if you like what you hear today, please share this podcast with a friend. It just may be what they need in their life today. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to talk about the power of putting words to work in your life, that words do create worlds. One morning, a rancher was working on his fence when a federal agent pulled up, got out of his car, and announced, "I'm here to inspect your ranch for illegally grown drugs." Well, the rancher pointed and said, "Okay, but don't go in that field over there." Well, the federal agent got red-faced and said, "Mister, I have the authority of the federal government with me." Reaching into his pocket, he pulls out his wallet, opens it up, shows the rancher, and says, "See this badge, old man? This badge means I'm allowed to go on any land, any place, and any field that I want. Have I made myself clear?" Well, the rancher apologizes and goes back to his chores. A short time later, the old rancher hears screaming. He looks up and sees the federal agent is running through the field chased by a huge Brahma bull. With every step the agent makes, the bull gains too. And just a few seconds before the bull is about to step on the agent, the rancher stands up and yells to the agent, "Your badge. Show him your badge." Well, like having a badge, we often give ourselves labels. And we often buy into those labels, and we act sometimes accordingly. Sometimes these labels are nothing more than a meaningless badge in the arena of life. But at other times, labels can also be powerful, and the words we use with those labels can have great impact. It's likely that you've seen the commercial that was popular a few years ago in which people placed the labels they use to define themselves on small signs stuck to themselves so that everyone could see those labels. And then they were asked the question, "If everyone could see how you label yourself, would you be comfortable with those labels?" You know, but the truth is, we often place labels on ourselves, don't we? Such as talented or unable or unworthy, fake, selfish, ugly, and the list goes on. Well, recently at MIT, students of an economics class thought they had a reason to relax when a representative walked in and told the students their instructor was sick. But before they could pack up and run away, they were told that a substitute would teach that day, and they were each given a written description of the professor and his background. One half of the class was given one description, and the other half were given a different description. The difference in the two descriptions was one word. In one sentence, the instructor was referred to as either warm or cold. The rest of the lengthy description was exactly the same for the two groups. At the end of the class period, the students were asked to complete a questionnaire. And it wouldn't surprise you to know that those who received the warm statement rated the teacher as pleasant, warm-hearted, popular, and humorous, while the others rated him as self-centered, formal, unpopular, and ruthless. In other words, a single word had the power to alter the student's perception of the professor. But the most revealing thing of all this is, we do this to ourselves. One word, one label can change our perception of ourselves. By the very fact that we tell ourselves, we're not able, or it might work for others, but not for me, or even that we're unhappy, does in fact not just change our view, but also the actual outcome of our efforts in life. And what if instead of one word or thought telling us why not, that we found one word or thought telling us why we can? You know, Jimmy Valvano often repeated a few of my favorite words. He said, "God must have loved ordinary people because he made so many of us. But every day, in every walk of life, ordinary people do extraordinary things. You are extraordinary." And sometimes we, and you, need a reminder of just how precious you are in the eyes of your Maker. It's easy to lose sight of this, isn't it? But this I know for sure. You and I have a purpose, and we're made to be exceptional. I feel this right to the core. I believe that regardless of our poor choices or mistakes, we can change and choose the path that leads to our true purpose. Words are a big deal. They can bring joy, answer prayers, give belief, and change perspectives. Have you ever changed your belief in something or someone based on words you've heard or read? If so, you're not alone. But very few people learn the talent of laying hold on words. In fact, two people can hear the same words and one lay hold on them to change their life and the other pay no attention at all. You know, I grew up in a small home in a small town. And as a family, there were 10 of us that grew up in that small house. We had little money and lots of chaos, and my parents did the best they could with the circumstances given to them. They, like all parents, weren't perfect. But one of the amazing things they did for me was they had a small room that should have been a bedroom because some of us kids were crammed into a limited number of rooms in our house. But this room was dedicated to be a small library. On the shelves of the library were books, and those books became my escape on many days when I needed peace. These books elevated my curiosity, gave me words I had never read, and took me to places I never imagined existed. My mother loved biographies. I read all of them. She loved the classics. I read those as well. One of those classics was To Kill a Mockingbird. It was written by Harper Lee. Born in 1926, this American novelist, an eventual Pulitzer Prize winner, was born in Monroeville, Alabama. Her parents chose her middle name, Harper, to honor a doctor named William Harper, who saved the life of her sister. Her real name was Nellie, her grandmother's name spelled backwards. Her father was an attorney and served in the Alabama state legislature, and her father once defended two black men accused of murdering a white storekeeper. Both clients, a father and a son, were hanged. When Harper was in high school, her teacher, Gladys Watson, gave her a label, gave her some hope, the identity that she was a writer, that she was good at writing. And while Harper would attend law school, she never quite graduated. She published several long stories while living in New York. Her friends were so impressed with her talent that they pooled their resources and gave Harper a year's worth of wages and said, "You have 1 year off from your job to write whatever you please. Merry Christmas." What a gift, as if to say, you are a writer. Put on your label. We believe in you, and now you have no excuse but to become who you're supposed to become. So in the spring of the next year, Harper delivered the manuscript for Go Set a Watchman to publishers. It fell into the hands of Tay Hohoff. Now, Hohoff said, "The spark of a true writer flashed in every line, but the manuscript, she felt, was not ready. It was a series of anecdotes, not well conceived." And Harper started revising one draft after another. Hohoff described the give and take between the author and editor. When she disagreed with a suggestion, we talked it out, sometimes for hours. And sometimes she came around to my way of thinking, sometimes I to hers. And sometimes the discussion would open up an entirely new line of thinking. One winter night, Harper threw her manuscript out the window into the snow before calling Hohoff in tears. Tay told her to march outside immediately and pick up the pages. Those pages and the story would be published in 1960 and won the Pulitzer Prize in 1961. The book has sold more than 40 million copies. Yes, the power of words. To tell a young woman from Alabama that you can write, you can persist. This is who you are. Your words will change young minds for generations. Well, her words had an impact on me. As you know from your English Lit class, the novel is set in a small Alabama town, and Scout Finch lives with her widowed father, Atticus, and her older brother, Jim. Judge Taylor in the town appoints Atticus to defend Tom Robinson, a black man who has been accused of raping a young white woman. Although many of the town's citizens disapprove, Atticus agrees to defend Tom to the best of his ability. Other children taunt Jim and Scout for Atticus's decision to defend Tom. Scout is tempted to stand up for her father's honor by fighting, even though he has told her not to do so. One night, Atticus faces a group of men intent on lynching Tom. Scout and Jim unexpectedly show up, and Scout inadvertently breaks up the mob by recognizing and talking to a classmate's father, causing the would-be lynchers to disperse. When Scout asks her father why he is doing what he's doing, he says, "This case, Tom Robinson's case, is something that goes to the essence of a man's conscience. Scout, I couldn't go to church and worship God if I didn't try to help that man." "Atticus, you must be wrong," she says. "How's that?" "Well, most folks seem to think they're right and you're wrong." "They're certainly entitled to think that, and they're entitled to full respect for their opinions," says Atticus. "But before I can live with other folks, I've got to live with myself. And the one thing that doesn't abide by majority rule is a person's conscience." "Well, as a young teenager, when I read this book, I realized that what other people think is not always the right way to go." At one point in the book, Jim and Scout feel disappointed in their father. At 50, he's older and less active than the dads of their peers. He doesn't seem to know how to do anything cool. And this opinion is transferred when Atticus takes down a rabid dog with a single bullet, and they learn that their father is known as the deadest shot in Macomb County. Jim becomes duly impressed with his father for this display of skill, all the more because Atticus had never felt the need to brag about his prowess. "You know, my father never did what other fathers did. He didn't toss the ball outside with me. He didn't shoot hoops. It wasn't his way. But I realized, like Atticus, he had things at which he was extremely good, and I started to value him for his character." And when Atticus tells Scout, "You can learn a simple trick, Scout, and you can get along better with all kinds of folks. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." These labels, these words, these ways of thinking were a gift to me from the pen of Harper Lee, who listened to the words of a high school teacher and some friends who gave her a year to become a writer. So, what about you? What labels, good labels, are waiting for you to put on your life and on the lives of your team and children? This is why leading and teaching is such a noble profession. By what you say and how you give, you can help others see who they really are. Words, the positive and good words you give to others, can make all the difference. I know this from firsthand experience. As a young man, I worked on a sod farm. Now, sod is a mature grass cut from the ground along with several inches of soil beneath the grass, held together by roots. To cut the sod, we used a large diesel harvester that weighed about 14 tons. It was mid-July, and I was assigned to work with my classmate on the back of the harvester. The harvester's blade was set to penetrate the ground about 2 inches below the surface, lifting 18-inch wide strips of grass, roots, and dirt onto a conveyor. The sod was then conveyed from the front of the harvester to the rear, where large rotating blades would cut the sod into 4-foot strips. Our job was to stack the 40-pound sod strips onto pallets. To do the stacking, we stood on platforms built over the double set of dual wheels that carried the weight of the workers on each side of the machine. Well, after 2 hours of work, we were moving the harvester from one end of the field to the other, and I was walking alongside the slow-moving harvester, and I attempted to jump onto the platform to sit next to my friend. But I misjudged my jump, and I landed only part way on the platform, lost my balance, and fell off the platform in front of the double set of dual wheels. I immediately tried to scurry out of the path of the wheels, but the big knobby tires caught my high-top sneakers, and the wheels started to roll up my leg, throwing me to the ground. I quickly realized I was in quite a predicament. I was now laying feet first, directly in the path of the wheels that were going to roll over the entire length of my body, starting with my feet and ending with my head, and there was nothing I could do about it. As the wheels rolled up my right leg, I felt my distal femur break in half above the knee. Next, the wheels and knobby tires rolled onto my pelvis, crushing it ruthlessly. I never felt anything so excruciatingly painful. My back and ribs were next to break in multiple places as the wheels crumpled my stomach and chest. Then the machine mercilessly twisted me onto my back, with the knobby treads passing over my shoulder and the side of my face and neck, miraculously missing most of my head. By the time the 14 tons finished their devastating work, I lost consciousness. The first thing I remember when I opened my eyes was the inconceivable pain. I couldn't breathe. It felt like I was underwater. I was trying to breathe, but it wasn't working the way it was supposed to work. I couldn't speak. I couldn't cry out, even though I frantically wanted to cry for help. Everything hurt, and I quickly grasped the fact that I was about to die. Honestly, the pain was so extreme that I wanted to die. I just wanted it to stop. I later learned that I had suffered a traumatic pneumothorax, or in simple terms, my lungs had collapsed. If there's a puncture in your lung due to trauma, the air escapes from the lung to the area outside of your lungs, yet inside your chest cavity. And as a result, your lungs are pushed together like a wet paper sack. The air inside your chest cavity is unable to escape, and the pressure keeps the lungs from expanding. This can lead to cardiac arrest or respiratory failure. Well, everything in my body was screaming for oxygen. And in my desperation to breathe, I had to expand my chest cavity to gather air. And the pain of my broken ribs and back from even the slightest movement was more than I could endure. Well, in a matter of minutes, the farm manager, Stan, arrived out of breath. He could sense I was deep in shock and on the verge of death, and he asked if I could move my legs. I couldn't respond. He knelt on the ground, took my head in his hands, and started to talk to me. For whatever reason, his words reached through my panic and pain. He told me I was strong. He prayed that I would live. Before that moment, it had never entered into my mind that I was going to live. The only thought I had had up until that moment was how long the pain would continue until I could die and make it go away. Stan continued, "McKay, you'll walk again." I started to believe. He told me I would graduate from school, hold positions of leadership, marry, go to college, and become a father. These words had a profound effect on my thinking. It was as if there was a tremendous tug of war going on inside me. On the one end of the rope was panic and pain, pulling me towards closing my eyes and giving in to death's grip. On the other end was the hope that Stan's words were giving me. In spite of all that was going on around me, I started to see, to imagine the very words Stan was speaking to me, and I started to lay hold on what he was saying. I started to believe. Now, I know I'm not unique in experiencing pain. I imagine you may question whether you can endure at times. Can you recover from an emotional injury or sickness? Can you persevere despite challenges? Maybe you felt like giving up at times in life's pursuit. If so, the lesson I learned on the dirt floor of that farm maybe can help you. What you believe, the words you lay hold on, matter. It would be more than 15 minutes, which seemed like 15 years, before the ambulance would arrive. The hospital ordered an insertion of a chest tube. This meant they would cut through my chest cavity and insert a tube to evacuate the excess air from my chest. It hurt so bad I couldn't cope. But soon thereafter, the pain in my chest subsided and I could breathe a little better. It took almost a year for me to recover. Much of the time I spent on my back in bed. I had to learn to walk again. Walking was something I wasn't sure I would be able to do again. And I learned a lot about myself. I learned life is a gift. It is a gift not to be wasted or squandered. And I try my best to remember. As Stan told me, I did graduate, marry, and go on to college. My goal in graduate school was to get a master's degree in business administration and to work for the Procter & Gamble Company. It took a lot of sleepless nights, sacrifice, my own money to earn my degree. But I got the job. And I remember my first day of work. I parked my car down the road and across the freeway from P&G's headquarters in Cincinnati. As I walked across the overpass bridge to my new job, I felt this huge sense of accomplishment. I'd done it. I was about to start a career for which I had struggled and sacrificed, but suddenly my thoughts changed. You know what I noticed? I noticed I was walking, and I remembered the words of Stan when he said, "You will walk again. You will hold positions of leadership and make a difference in the world." And a sudden rush of pins and needles hit me and brought on a flood of emotion. There I was, dressed in my new suit, headed to my first day of professional work, crying like a baby as I walked into my new life. Now, I've reflected on that day and the words Stan gave me many times. Pain and circumstances left me hoping to die, but Stan's words removed it and replaced it with a new belief window. And this started my obsession with the concept of words and belief. And that obsession led to my PhD in research on what enables human beings to change. In that research, we demonstrated that words create our reality. Words we lay hold of build a window of belief through which we view the world. You, at this very moment, are living, filtering, thinking, and seeing through the prism of your belief window. And it can keep you from change or enable you to change. It has the power to do either. Replace your belief window and you can replace old actions, old habits, and old ways of relating to the world. In 2007, teaming up with my major professor, we led a large study on how people face their biggest challenges and win. First thing we did in our research was to identify people who had overcome significant challenges, made successful changes in their life, and became who they wanted to become as leaders and people. Then we administered the Washington University Sentence Completion Test. In this test, respondents complete sentences. The way they complete the sentence gives insight to their belief window or ego, their self-identity. We also tested dozens of other factors, personality traits, age, race, education, wealth, work, experience, attitude, and more. We were seeking the factor that enabled them to change. And what we learned was it was not age or experience or personality factors. What we found in the end was how a person viewed themselves. Their sense of personal identity was the single most powerful factor to a person's success. And then through a series of interviews, we explored how they formed their identity. The answer? They were able to lay hold of words that they heard or read and use those words as the catalyst and motive for change and forming their identity. This was a fascinating discovery. You mean some people have the talent or ability to hear words and turn those words into action, and some people don't? What enables some people to have this talent? Well, we subsequently went to work to discover the answer to that question. As we did, we learned there are two contributing factors to the people in our study who laid hold on words. First, life circumstances had placed them in a position of humility. There were divorces, job losses, and other conditions that caused the person to be seeking words that could help them. And within each of these people was a unique combination of humility and faith. They were humble enough to seek help and faithful enough to place trust in the words they were hearing. But interestingly, not all of our study participants had suffered a life change. They also possessed the humility to listen to and the faith to lay hold on words and take action. So, what words are coming into your life that are helping you to see and believe and live differently? Well, in their book, Words Can Change Your Brain, the authors conclude a single word has the power to influence the expression of genes that regulate physical and emotional stress. Furthermore, exercising positive thoughts can quite literally change one's reality. They say by holding a positive and optimistic word in your mind, you stimulate frontal lobe activity. This area includes specific language centers that connect directly to the motor cortex responsible for moving you into action. And as our research has shown, the longer you concentrate on positive words, the more you begin to affect other areas of the brain. Well, the authors say this, "We'd like to give you a little experiment right now. But make sure you have a pen and a piece of paper handy. Now ask yourself this question. What is my deepest personal value? Listen to the subtle inner voices speaking to you. Then think of the word that captures the quality of your deepest personal value. Write any word, as many words that come to mind. Courage, kindness, constructive, integrity, persistence, whatever those words might be. Then circle the one that feels the truest for you at this moment. Then close your eyes again and repeat the word to yourself silently and then aloud. Then, they say, take this word and speak it to yourself often. Their research shows that by doing this, you're able to cope with stress better. It can and does direct your actions and can impact your life in more ways than you think possible. For example, research shows that a hateful word may cause your brain to flood your bloodstream with hormones, squandering resources from your body budget. And just as a single word can rob your energy, a single word or words can fill your being with energy. A study published in Positive Psychology took a group of adults aged 35 to 54 who were given a nightly task of writing down three things that went well for them that day, including an explanation of why. The following 3 months showed their degrees of happiness continued to rise and their feelings of depression continued to decline. Another study published in Positive Psychology took a group of adults ages 35 to 54 who were given the nightly task of writing down three things that went well for them during the day. After 3 months, the results showed their degree of happiness continued to rise and their feelings of depression continued to decline. Words have great power. Now, on my mother's bookshelf was a large copy of the Bible. Not many people nowadays read the Old Testament. Perhaps it's because it seems a bit out of date or irrelevant. Perhaps it's because we rely more on Google or Instagram for answers nowadays. And in the Old Testament, there are definitely some books that are read less than others. Isaiah is one of those books. It's hard to understand, often repetitive and easy to dismiss and not applicable to our lives today. But a little more than halfway through the book of Isaiah, as he writes to the children of Israel, he shifts gears from his warnings, understanding that they now have been conquered by their enemies and carried away into other lands and separated from their families and faith. As a people, they have fallen, they have lost, and they have no way to move forward. And Isaiah's message turns to hope. In the 40th chapter, he speaks as if he was Israel and says, "I can't see a way out. I've fallen. What can we do? There's no path for us." To this, he speaks on behalf of God, as if God himself were speaking from the heaven and says, "Have you not heard? Don't you know that the Lord, the creator of the earth, has the strength and understands you and your situation? And he gives power to the faint, and to them that have no might, he gives strength. And he says to those who keep their faith, they shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and shall walk and not faint." In other words, don't give up on your faith. God is a God of renewal and restoration, and your day is coming. You may have made mistakes. You may be stuck in a habit or a rut, but you can rise. And I believe you can rise and will walk and run on a new path if you'll just do whatever you can to lay hold upon words that will change your belief window. Words changed my life as a young man. I've reflected on them again and again, that despite being crushed and injured, that I could run and walk and not be weary. And it was later in life that I realized that God gives this promise to all of us, the ability to restore what has been lost, that he will not leave us. So remember the power of words to change your life, to change your mind, to give you gifts meant for you to help you prosper in life. Remember the power of words to help your team and your family and your children. Words matter. Use them and watch. You will rise to become who you are destined to become in life. Most of all, thanks for joining us today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend. And join us next week for another podcast as we seek to open our eyes to who and what we can become.